Welcome to the Smart Tech Check podcast, hosted by Mark Vina, your home for candid, insightful, and provocative conversations about the smart home, home automation, security, smartphones, PC and console gaming, and much more.
Hi, everyone. My name is Mark Vina, host of the Smart Tech Check podcast. Today is Wednesday, May 21st, 2025. Joining me for today's podcast are Stuart Walpin, subscribed for Popular Mechanics, AARP, Techlicious, Investopedia, and other terrific publications. Rob Pedrero, who writes about tech developments at PC Mag, Fast Company, and other fine publications as well. And good old John Quang, who writes the New York Times, Smart Cities, and Tom Sky. John, Rob, and Stuart, welcome to the podcast.
Good to be back.
Good to see you.
Hello.
Rob is at Google I.O., and we're going to specifically talk about that, so hold your fire.
Coming to you live and direct in California.
Stuart is angry at me because the Yankees took 2 out of 3 last weekend. John, how are you doing, John? How are you?
I've survived the tornadoes in St. Louis and back in New York, and yeah. So, and it's like March here, so...
Well, we've got a great podcast coming down the path here with some topics I certainly want to get all of your feedback on. But, John, there was a topic that you wanted to talk about. I didn't have time to add it to the agenda. But it was I really want to address that because I thought it was pretty important. You want to tee that up?
Oh, sure. Well, you know, we've been working on personalized medicine for years and different forms of personalized medicine, you know, drugs that would be tailored, compounds that would be tailored just for your illness and things like that. But the most promising avenue has really been gene therapy, you know, genetically reengineering some of your cells or your DNA to attack a tumor, let's say, or knock out a gene that's mutated or knock in something that's missing, that in this case, a protein that's lacking for this child. And it was recorded in the New York Times and on This Week in Bioethics site I do as well. Just to note, it was one of the first truly personalized gene therapies that was done for this child who had a genetic disease. It's a single gene, I should point out, disease. So that's easier to address. If it's multiple genes, there's a potential for off-target edits and side effects. And there have been some bad outcomes in the past. But in this case, the disease this child had would have meant that the child would have died almost within weeks of being born. And the doctors basically got to work and teamed up with people at UPenn to come up with a gene therapy catered, personalized specifically for this child. And they managed to do it in about 7 months, which that is really a remarkable feat because you're talking about sequencing the genomes, tracing it, making sure that there won't be off-target edits, coming up with this particular edit. The vector that they need is like a plasmid that they, a nano plasma they could insert that goes to the liver in this case. And it all has to work. All these pieces have to come together to work perfectly and insert this in the liver and get these cells basically going in the liver to compensate for this problem, which they managed to do. So it's really a remarkable achievement. And it's kind of a milestone because it's something that people have talked about for many, many years. And now somebody has actually done it successfully. And it's a pathway too, if it could be done more economically and it's streamlined in a way, then it shows the opportunity for a lot of really rare illnesses. There are tens of thousands of people in the States with your basically illnesses, rare diseases that are not on the map for any big pharma company to come up with a solution or a treatment or a therapy. This gives people like that hope, and it's a pretty remarkable thing.
When do you think it'll be deployed? Right now, it sounds like a bit of a, you know, confined deployment, but you think they'll be widely deployed within 5 years? You
know, I think that you're going to see more and more cases of this, and there's so many people working on it. Widely deployed, that's, you know, a matter for the American healthcare system, such as it is. Is the technology there? You know, these people have proven it. It's quite a team of people. A fellow I followed on the West Coast, actually, who's, you know, very cautious about some of this engineering, and they made some of the components that went into this. But I think as soon as possible, really. Sorry about that.
John did that for dramatic effect.
And I appreciate it. As soon as possible before, you know, and obviously, you know, these are rare diseases, and these are also things that they're fast-tracked as well. I should point out that this was fast-tracked with an exception, you know, that you can do in certain cases with really severe illness like this. So there were approvals. It went through the standard IRB, the institutional review boards, et cetera, to get it going. But just remarkable that they were able to do all of this in about 7 months, something that, you know, before to come up with a gene therapy like this is years in the making for many of these, many years. So pretty astounding.
Well, John, can I ask a question, Mark?
Yeah.
Is there a limit or a certain category of diseases or illnesses that gene therapy is effective for versus some that are not, for instance, like cancer or muscular diseases like ALS or muscular dystrophy or cystic fibrosis? I mean, is there a category of illnesses or diseases that gene therapy is particularly effective for and other categories of diseases that it is not particularly effective for?
Sure, there definitely is for some of these. I mean, potentially in all of them, but when it's something like ALS, where there's a couple of variants, and MS, there are different types of MS, and also they're working on a gene therapy for that now that looks very promising as well. So yeah, if it's like what we call a single gene, genetic disorder where a protein isn't being made or one's being made in excess because of a mutation in that gene or a base pair, then that looks like a prime candidate for it. Of course, that's the proviso that you don't learn that later on there turns out to be something else that is like a non-coding sequence that doesn't tell you about to make proteins, but might actually have some effect on the way the gene is expressing itself. And that it's where, as people learn more, they learn more every week, and the whole picture of DNA changes every week. But yeah, some of those diseases, to Stuart, your point, are a single, as far as we know, gene deformity or mutation. And those are the prime ones that they want to go after first, because the chances are that you're going to do some really terrible thing, like cause cancer because of an off-target edit, are minimal that way. Are minimized at least in that way. So that's the hope at least. And then we can start getting broader.
Well, yeah, let's get into the other topics, but we should talk about offline about doing a specific kind of carve out for this, because it's a big topic, you know, and we rarely talk about, you know, medical related issues like that. And that sounds like an incredible opportunity for the world, assuming of course it gets funded, but that's a different discussion. Let's talk about WWDC. I just got invited, and I'm excited that Apple has invited me to another WWDC. This one is going to be particularly important, chiefly because Apple Intelligence, if I shall say it diplomatically, it hasn't exactly lit the world on fire for a variety of different issues. I think Apple, in general, is still struggling where, you know, where Apple Intelligence and AI kind of fits into it. Now, personally, you know, their implementation so far at the operating system level, I have found to be a pretty beneficial thing. But there really hasn't been a home run app that drives you, you know, to go out and buy a Mac. I think there's some stuff that kind of around the edges is pretty interesting. But, you know, I'm sure we're going to hear about a major redesign. That's the rumor mill is kind of in high gear about that, a kind of new look and feel for the mobile device operating systems, iOS and iPad OS, probably more visual enhancements than Mac OS. So that'll be kind of interesting. I'm hearing a lot about live translation. That will be very cool if they implement that, especially via AirPods. That's kind of the rumor right now. You know, I still think they are creeping more and more down the path of getting to a unified operating system across everything. I mean, right now they've got the silicon in place to do that. And there's a lot of financial reasons. I always look at things from a business standpoint. I mean, Apple CFO would be very happy if they could get to you know, a smaller number of engineers working on a common platform. That's the, from a business standpoint, but also for the fact, I think that ultimately you'll see this next year. I mean, they've been completely absent from the foldable design space. And I think the problem that not, you wouldn't see it this year, but perhaps next year, you'll see a folding iPad that's also a MacBook at the same time. And maybe we'll hear about some of that stuff come out from an operating system implementation standpoint. But anyway, Rob, I'll ask you about it. I'm going to ask you to lead off, even though you're in enemy territory.
Apple's that way. Actually, I think it was that way. So anyway, building is directly that way.
Yeah, yeah. I'm sure Google has somebody that's going to shut down the podcast because we're going to talk about Apple.
You see somebody come with throw a bag over my head. Yeah, that's. Yes.
What are you expecting? Do you got anything that you'll be looking out for?
So, you know, it was last year's WWDC, right, where they had this concept video showing what Apple Intelligence was going to do, which Apple Intelligence still does not do, which led John Gruber, who is generally one of the most sympathetic raconteurs of Apple's exploits. I have never seen him as pissed off about the company as he was, saying Apple wide in this demo and essentially suggesting this is a Tim Cook problem because somebody had to authorize selling vaporware, something that Apple usually doesn't do. So I'm wondering, are we going to have a little more of a reality check on where they're, what they're doing with all this stuff? Because, yeah, they burned a lot of trust. Also be interesting to see what their outreach to developers, I say iOS developers, now that they have finally been forced to stop some of the most abusive conduct in the App Store.
I knew you were going to say that. I knew you were going to bring up that word.
Fortnite. Where she got accused an Apple vice president of lying in court. Speaking of pissed off, that judge, Yvette Gonzalez-Rogers, clearly not amused with Apple's strategy of malicious compliance. So, you know, in a scenario where I don't think Apple's going to be able to, you know, keep taking 30 or 15 cents of every dollar sold for an in-app transaction, even for things that are have no Apple role whatsoever, no Apple hosting or anything, that's changed. So they got to find some way to give developers other reasons to use their in-app purchasing.
Right. But do you think you'll see any surprises at all? I mean, there's been a couple of rumors that we might see a HomePod that's kind of like an Alexa with a screen and a better speaker.
I'd actually like to see that because there's I think there is a market for a privacy optimized smart home hub, a smart speaker.
Yeah.
Apple is better positioned to do that. I find that more credible. Like the idea we're going to have, you know, a folding tablet or a touchscreen MacBook. You know, if Apple thought that was a good idea, they could have done it in an Apple-esque way at any point in the last 5 years. They just don't seem to think people want a touchscreen real computer.
Yeah. I mean, well, you know, Apple kind of talks themselves into it. Remember, you know, you remember the famous question that Steve Jobs got, you know, why don't you put a stylus on the iPad? You have a stylus. It's called your finger, you know?
Yes, yes.
So
Added a stylus, you know, they blew it.
Well, and what I love about Apple, and I know, Stuart, you'll agree with this, is that, you know, Apple doesn't like to acknowledge mistakes. But when they do make a change, then they kind of pretend that the past never happened. And we you know, this is the way we meant this from the beginning. You know, so ignore that, you know, what happened behind the curtain, you know, for the last 10 years. So, Stuart, what do you think is going
to happen? Well, just on that point, the Apple translation is, to me, very intriguing because obviously there are any number of earbuds that you could buy now that are also double as translation devices. And there are several companies that are essentially founded on the whole precept of you buy our headphones and their translators in your ears. And I think what Apple is going to do is sort of going to upend that, even though they're going to do something that's already been established and done the last 3 or 4 years, in fact. The fact is that they're going to make it backward compatible with AirPods, especially in use, probably the Pro models. The iPods are the single largest selling earbuds in the market. Right. And if all of a sudden every single one of them, or at least all the Pro models, suddenly become translating devices, that's a market disruptor, despite the fact that Apple isn't really inventing the technology. They're simply spreading it around. On the AI side,
and I think that solution could have really wide appeal. I mean, that's
correct.
that's not a niche solution. So that
No, not at all. That's exactly what I mean, especially even in the U.S. where you have such large Spanish-speaking populations who are trying to assimilate into, now that English is the official language of the U.S., we all think of translation as English into other languages for our purposes, where for immigrants, it becomes a very, very important sort of assimilation piece. So I think that it's going to have, and considering how global Apple is, it's just not for Americans or Europeans to travel around. This is something that all these AirPods, that 10 million devices or something like that, that already exist, suddenly turn into instant language translators. So I think that is a truly disruptive thing, simply because of the installed base there already is, as opposed to having to buy a new product.
Right.
The other thing that I'm struck by is what Rob was talking about AI is the, I don't know if it's a rumor, but you're at I/O, so you should be able to tell this, that one of the rumors is that Apple will be adding Google Gemini, to one of the AI choices in Safari alongside ChatGPT.
I haven't heard anything about that. But
that's a rumor that's going around. Yeah,
that is a rumor that is going around. So I don't know if you want to check on that, Rob. But right now, I mean, when anybody who does a search on Siri right now, it's basically confronted with, would you like us to search with ChatGPT or on the web? And I'm going, just tell me the answer. I don't care where you get it. And maybe with the addition of Gemini, you get a little less of, tell us where you want us to find the answer, as opposed to just tell me the answer.
Yeah. John seems to be very excited there. I don't know. I think he's watching Game 6 of the Knicks series.
I'm just the AI, it's just coming back to me, do we have some summer reading for you? Here are some summer reading ideas for you folks out there. Pretty bad use of AI with fake books being recommended by Chicago Sun-Times and Philadelphia newspapers. Excellent. Very good. So, and I just saw, I'm not picking on you, Rob, or anything, but you are there just reporting what you're seeing at Google I/O and the CEO saying, well, we're getting such great response from the AI and our search engine. And I'm like, has he used it? Are you kidding me? Oh my gosh. Most people I know try to chop that part of the screen off or close it or something, because most of it's wrong. Even the fact that they have to superimpose on the side the actual sources of the information that they messed up means it's not working, right? But anyway, it's kind of a juggernaut we can't stop. So I guess it's going to happen.
Well, it's going to be a really interesting event. I tend not to want to overstate the importance of these events, but this one's
a good
episode. And the reason why I say that is that, consumers have headed up to here with AI. And guys like this, we're in the business. We understand that sometimes it takes a long time for technology to kind of sort itself out and, usage models to get traction. But at the end of the day, what I think is at risk, I don't think it's at risk in the next 60 days or the next 6 months, but I think at some point, if the AI promise and potential, if that turns into, oh, come on, it's like waiting for Godot. We've been waiting for the promise of this to arrive. You start to lose interest with customers, with consumers. So I hope that doesn't happen. Apple tends to be, during these events, a little less flashy than some of the other companies that are on the market when they're bringing technology to the market. And I agree with some of the sentiments expressed here in that, there's been a lot of disappointment. Apple made a lot of promises that has not been delivered. And let's face it, as we all know, there's been a lot of shakeup behind the scenes. They've completely kind of reorganized the group responsible for Apple Intelligence, and they've moved some leadership around. And so I do think that people get it. And we've got to go to the next topic, but I would like to hear a little bit more about Vision Pro. What are they going to do? Is Vision Pro supposedly going to get some more Apple Intelligence stuff? They're certainly not going to announce the new hardware, but Vision Pro has been kind of left behind. So from the whole AI thing. So hopefully we'll hear a bit more about that. But the next topic I want to address, and this is your baby, Stuart, there is a good book out.
Talking about summer reading.
Yeah, exactly. But it's an important one, given a whole variety of different topics going on with all the tariff stuff. And now Apple has moved closer to the Trump administration, you know, on a variety of different levels, like obviously because that's what companies do when a new president comes into power. But you know, I want to get your perspective, because have you read the entire book?
I'm 20% through it, and it is so appealing to me simply as a tech history nerd, because it is the same. I mean, there have been a lot of histories of Apples out there. There's a Walter Isaacson book on Steve Jobs, obviously, but this one is focused primarily on the supply chain production side. And how Apple moved, was the last, really one of the last companies in the U.S. at least, to move away from self-manufacturing to offshoring or outsourcing. And the premise of the book is essentially, I want to preface this by saying that the author, Patrick McGee, was on The Daily Show Monday night with Jon Stewart, and they did it almost 20-minute section.
So just pause. That great news organization, The Daily Show.
Daily Show.
Thank you. Yeah. I know that's where Rob gets his news. Go ahead.
Yeah. Jon Stewart conducted about almost a 20-minute interview with the author, which is fascinating in and of itself, even without the book. But basically, the premise is that Apple, without any intention, essentially taught China how to be modern China in terms of becoming a tech manufacturing thing. Not a manufacturing hub, not only for smartphones and other technology, but also on the supplier side, teaching these suppliers how to do it, which bled into military hardware and all sorts of other modern hardware that is making modern China. So the whole premise of the book is, without meaning to do so, they were only following, you know, trying to get the best work and the cheapest work that they could to get their products out, was to essentially build modern China technologically.
Has the book addressed, and I'm sure it will address it, but have you gotten into the 20% of the book that it's addressed some of the ethical issues about, you know, deploying these large factories in Asia? Some of the working conditions, you know, famously.
The parts that I've read so far is addressing some of the sweatshop conditions that Apple created in Mexico and some of the other offshore facilities, like as well as South Korea, before they moved to China. The book starts essentially, it starts with 2013 and Xi Jinping coming into power and immediately dumping on Apple until Apple essentially bent the knee. But it really starts with Steve Jobs coming back to Apple in 1999 with the development of the iMac and the decision to offshore or outsource the building of the iMac to LG, primarily LG in South Korea, which started it down this path. And Apple finding, as it went to varying sources, including Singapore and Ireland and Mexico and Wales, that eventually China just became the logical place for it to do a lot of. And Apple sent all of these engineers to essentially train all of its suppliers on how to do it. And of course, once you train a supplier on how to do it, Apple actually encouraged them to apply that knowledge elsewhere. So they weren't totally reliant on Apple for their business, because if Apple took their business away, there'd be no company. So Apple was actually encouraging its suppliers to find other places to sell its expertise in order to remain in business for Apple. And in so doing, they trained this entire generation of Apple suppliers, of tech suppliers, component suppliers, supply chain people, and that's why you're seeing the Huawei's and the Xiaomi's and the Vivos and the Oppos suddenly doing what they can do, because everybody that they work with or their suppliers were trained by Apple.
Right. And you know, John, the interesting thing on the topic that Stewart's bringing up that's addressed in this book, and I was in the middle of all this stuff at Compaq in the late 90s when Compaq went down the path of, you know, we can make our computers, you know, final assembly in Asia and bring costs down 20-25%. And if you recall Compaq back in the day, we built everything in Houston. It was a very fancy factory, and we employed local people. And then, Taiwan Inc. came in and said, basically, you know what, whatever your cost is, we can go lower. And it created a tremendous amount of, of course, it lowered the cost of technology, which is always a good thing from a consumer standpoint. you know, during that period, and I think Apple probably helped with this, is that offshoring in the late 90s was kind of a crapshoot, because a lot of those ODM, a lot of those ODMs, the Quantas of the world, the Foxconns of the world, they didn't have the expertise. They had to be taught how to do it. And Apple, you know, because Apple has very high standards, especially when you're building smartphones and other products like that. So I think what Stuart is saying, Apple not only did this to lower their costs, they also enabled Taiwan and China, by extension, become best in class, because the Chinese are really good at mimicking and doing, you know, and that's a skill. And I haven't seen a fucking way, but they're really, really good. You tell us how to do it, we'll do it better. You know?
Right. Well, I think you're right. I mean, it's an interesting point in the book. It's a play on Nixon in China, and I'm wondering if there's going to be like a Philip Glass opera coming out, Apple in China. But a lot of companies, most of us have had friends or people or visited Asia on our own. So you go into a factory in Asia over the past 30 years or so or more, and people are taking notes. You know, you go down and say, well, gee, this doesn't look quite right, or the seatbelt really should be, you know, slide for this kind of a driver, or you mentioned some other tweak, and they go and they fix it right away. They are just absorb, learn, assimilate the information and push it forward. So a lot of companies are doing that, from toy manufacturers, for example, did very similar things. They were flying back and forth to China all the time, just because there was a toy or a trinket or something they wanted to make and they wanted it done a certain way. And people learn that very quickly. So very interesting book, Stuart. Yeah, I think it's a really interesting thesis as well, but certainly happened, right?
Right. And it really informs our modern thing, because right now Apple is trying not to necessarily get out of China. But it looks to me that they're repeating what they did in China in India. And right. India, of course, is a much friendlier place, at least as far as the U.S. and foreign policy is concerned, than China is. And so now Apple is being pulled not only by Trump to reshore and now by China to stay in China, and as well as India now pulling them in and Apple wanting to diversify. So they're not so as reliant on China as they had been, essentially escaping the Frankenstein monster they helped create.
Right. I thought all those factories were coming here. They're not coming here.
Well, no, I'm afraid not. But I want Rob to address the geopolitical topic that we brought up, because, John, you made a very good point. You go back to the early 70s when Nixon opened China with Kissinger, right, which was really a play against, the friend of your enemy is the enemy of your enemy is your friend. And I think there was a belief that by opening the China economy, which is really all of this started in the early 70s. I mean, we're starting to see the effect now. But the belief was, and I think you guys will agree with this, that the Kissinger approach was that, hey, if we get the Chinese economy rolling, even though they're a communist country, when you build this humongous middle class, which is essentially what's happened over in China, ultimately, that will be able to overcome communism. Now, unfortunately, that's not the way it's worked out so far.
Remember that China was invited to join the WTO, and yeah, it was Xi Jinping who essentially sort of reversed course for the country to make it go back to more totalitarianism than it was before. They were the West was making inroads in the Chinese market in the late 90s by its acceptance into the WTO. So it was a worldwide effort. It wasn't just a U.S. effort.
I agree with all that. But the question I have for Rob is, are we seeing a repeat Tim Cook in China thing, meaning that Apple is aware that there are a lot of things that go on in China that they're not crazy about, whether it's the IP theft. That's a real hardcore issue for them. But the way they treat employees at factories, and they give them a pass because they're giving them a pass simply because they realize that China can't slow the inevitability of time. That over time, communism, they will become a much more friendly country from a political governance standpoint. Now, maybe I'm completely off the reservation with that, but I wonder, Rob, you have thoughts on that? On that part of the topic?
I mean, the whole notion that's been the big bet of U.S. geopolitical strategy over the past 30, 40 years, that, you know, as China gets wealthier, it will become more democratic. We're basically making the same bet on Vietnam. And it is true that Korea used to be under a military dictatorship. It got wealthy and it is now such a functioning democracy that, you know, they actually know how to impeach a president and make it stick. it's interesting looking at Apple because in general, they like to own their technology. They don't want to use someone else's hardware, software. And yet here they have this massive, you know, I guess, liability that this China has so much leverage over them because Apple as a company doesn't exist without Chinese manufacturing capacity. And they're trying to fix that by building up a supply chain in India. They're building iPhones in Brazil. I think they've realized that it is not awesome to have that much dependency. And John, you literally went sideways.
Yeah, I think
this whole podcast is going sideways.
He's taking a nap. Leave him alone.
It's all going sideways. Sorry.
He's playing with his camera settings. I know what he's doing.
It's also not great for Apple's users since, you know, the way Apple has constructed iOS, it gives the Chinese Communist Party an enormous amount of leverage over how the iPhone works in China because, you know, there's sideloading allowed in Europe, required by Europe. Apple has put themselves as the sole control over what software you can put on an iPhone. And of course, the CCP is using that as, Apple's going to do what the CCP tells them to do in China.
Well, this has that great material for a movie, and I can't wait to see who plays Tim Cook. Number of different actors I can think of. Let's go to our last topic. I mean, I'm going to start with Rob because you're in the hornet's nest there in Mountain View. I'll just say one thing, thematic thing, because I have watched some of the keynote activity. Seems like Google is very aware their $200 billion search business may be a bit at risk because people are now turning to ChatGPT and other AI services. I mean, I can speak for myself that I rarely use Google for search. You know, I love the fact I can use ChatGPT or other bots like that to essentially ask the question. A very complex question, by the way, and 98% of the time get a really reasonable answer. You know, I mean, so it sounds like they're doing some really interesting video stuff, which I don't know whether you saw a lot of that, you know, but with video creation using AI tools. But from your perspective, Rob, you were there. What can you report on?
Apparently AI is going to be a really big thing, guys. I'm confused.
Thanks for the update, Rob.
What'll be interesting is to see how this stuff gets received, because the whole notion that you will have Google's Gemini as this kind of ever-present, personal, powerful, proactive agent that is looking out for you, and, you know, maybe people don't want to have Gemini butting in to say, you know, hey, what about this? What about this? I see this is on your schedule. You know, how much time do people want to spend talking to that? The whole way Google is redefining web search as this increasingly conversational AI experience, a lot of people in my profession are kind of terrified about what that's doing to click-throughs. And Google's only comment on that was during a press briefing Monday, where their VP of search, Liz Reed, said the people who do click through are higher quality. They spend a lot more time. I heard that story.
You've got to admire the creativity of that response, but go ahead.
I'm going to tell my editors, yes, I file late, but my copy is higher quality as a result, so it's all fine. So that's really unclear how that's going to work out. The whole notion that, you know, Google is going to sort of tell you what's going on in the world because of work other people did. This is going to be a very interesting conversation, and certainly how all the various court cases proceeding, Google's display ads business, from that judge's opinion, looks like that should be blown up because they've monopolized both ends of that market in the way that's not helping my industry at all. The search antitrust case, you know, I guess Google is making search a different experience. They're definitely trying to build up services. You know, they announced they have so many different service plans. They now have AI Ultra, $250 a month, which gets you access to basically everything, 30 terabytes of storage, full access to the Flow movie making app. You know, they want to be, you know, I guess Adobe should be a little worried about all the efforts Google is putting into AI image and video generation. They're also getting back into wearables. They have Android XR, which I tried on these glasses yesterday. And, you know, the Google Glass dream will never die, but these don't make you look like collective.
Rob, were you impressed with the video tools that they announced, the AI video tools, the Flow capability?
Yeah. I mean, you know, I guess the thing is, you know, who's the market? I guess if you're in like advertising or presentations, because AI generated stuff can't be copyrighted. So Hollywood is never going to use this in a movie. You might use this to workshop stuff, but you're going to have enough human in the loop so it can be copyrightable and therefore, you know, can make sure people can't upload copies of it at will around the internet. But really impressive stuff. They show that off at length throughout the keynote. You know, I think applications of AI like live translation, they show that in Google Meet, that's a really good use case. And it's something that, you know, it's actually useful. Whereas, you know, do you need to spend all your time talking to an AI chatbot? That I'm not sure about the utility.
Rob, have you seen Google Beam?
I have not. It is being demoed somewhere over that way. This is what it was called, Project Starline, when it was shown off.
Starline.
It's a 3D video where they take, I think, six cameras and synthesize that into a very high definition experience. So basically, you know, you're the Cadillac of video conferencing, I guess.
Well, apparently, according to reports, that HP, they're working with HP to package it, and they've already sold it to a number of corporate clients that they're going to start installing, I guess, in the fall. And supposedly, it's an experience. It's almost like you're in the room, like the guy described it as like a Star Trek holodeck experience.
But I like that. It's not a consumer application. I mean, it's an enterprise.
Yet.
No, I realize that.
There's a lot of hardware. So apparently HP is going to show off their hardware at Infocom in like, 3 weeks or whatever, which I think is in somewhere around the Bay Area.
So, Stuart, your thoughts?
Well, the Google Beam, it was intriguing to me. And they were also talking about more improvements to Google Gemini, because obviously, as John was making fun of, is that all of these AIs still lack a great deal of accuracy. And the word is, I mean, listen, this is technology. You start out with bear skins and stone knives, and then you get to the moon. So, I mean, all of these technologies, especially AI, I think we just have to recognize that we are still in the sending dogs into space mode where AI is concerned. And that technology in Moore's Law, and with the coming of quantum computing, all of these sorts of technologies, and every time I read about these advances, I'm reminded of the Arthur C. Clarke quote that modern technology appears to a lot of people as magic. And I think we're just getting so close to that. John was talking about, you know, the gene editing technology. And most people go in, oh, we can cure this now. And it's like Dr. McCoy putting the thing on the guy's forehead to cure some hematoma, you know. So, I mean, a lot of this to me is fascinating, but I'm looking at it as an evolutionary process as opposed to, oh, look what we've done. It's where we are and where we're going.
Leave it to Stuart.
The corollary to that Arthur C. Clarke line is any sufficiently advanced technology is indistinguishable from a rigged demo.
A magic.
Right? A rigged demo.
Leave it to Stuart that in 2 minutes he can make a reference to Star Trek. Gene Roddenberry, Arthur C. Clarke, 2001: Space Odyssey, and actually make it sound pretty reasonable.
Thank you. I'm here all week trying to deal.
John, let me let you wrap it up in the last couple of minutes we have.
Well, I think it's. I'm curious to see what you know what Rob ultimately gets out of Google there at I/O, and hopefully it's more than just sunshine. Yeah, so I, exactly what we need. Another water bottle at a press event. That's exactly what we need. but I, you know, I think it'll be new models of AI, and it's interesting to see how Google's trying to adapt to this new landscape. And hopefully we'll get something as we started out with from Apple, finally, that, you know, that's the idea anyway. Get some competition going.
I can't wait to see some of the video stuff, because in my line of work, you know, I'm doing videos all the time, and anytime I can
use
the tool to create content quicker, faster, and by the way, with unbelievable resolution, some of the demos I've seen, this is not Charlie Chaplin like videos. These are pretty sophisticated, but I'm sure we'll be following up more on that. So guys, thanks for taking the time to join me for today's podcast. For our viewing and listening audience, thanks for making the Smart Tech Check podcast part of the day. Please make sure that you hit the like and subscribe buttons at the end of today's podcast, or use these on-screen QR codes to connect with me. You can also follow me on X @MarkVinaTechGuy. And until next time, guys, have a great week.